Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. Graham Fuller has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam and A World Without Islam. His latest book is Three Truths and a Lie, a memoir. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And obviously, I want to continue the discussion about Afghanistan. Having just spoken, I'm sorry about the connection, but he's on a cell phone somewhere in the north of Afghanistan. And apparently, the Taliban...
Sounds very romantic.
but the Taliban apparently regularly blow up cell phone towers. So we did the best we could. Were you able to hear it okay?
Fair amount of it, yes.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. And I apologize to our audience, too. But I thought it was an important thing to have somebody that's had this long perspective, having gone in there in the beginning.
Absolutely.
And 11 years later. But let's just, if we can, before we begin with Afghanistan, just touch on the big stories involving the CIA, Graham Fuller. There is, of course, this soap opera surrounding the current, well, it was the leader of the CIA, now he's resigned, General Petraeus. So he's the, you know, the scandal-plagued former head. But his recent testimony, from what we know, before this Senate Select Intelligence Committee, essentially made fools out of the Republican leaders like John McCain and Lindsey Graham and others, as well as Fox News, have been grandstanding and beating the drum on Benghazi for months, trying to turn a minor tragedy into a major issue. At least that's my perspective. What's yours?
Well, I think that's right on the mark, Ian. I mean, basically, I think this is a struggle among personalities and powers in Washington with fairly thin gruel as far as the nature of scandals or who knew what and when. And certainly the fact that it came around right at the end of the electoral campaign heightened the whole business. So I really don't seriously think there is a strategic issue worth discussing here. I know that Petraeus is quite a bright mind and a serious thinker about a lot of issues, but I think a lot of people do feel that the so-called surge in Iraq was whatever did happen there was the product largely of other events and forces that were taking place, and even less successful in Afghanistan. So, you know, I whatever his virtues as a military commander and officer and thinker, I would regret the appointment, and this isn't the first time, obviously, of a military man to head CIA. I think the military has lots of very serious and very good thinkers, but they also command a huge proportion of geopolitical turf in the world, and I do regret seeing essentially civilian institutions slightly militarized and brought in under the wing of military thinking, as was the case in appointing Petraeus to head of CIA. So I don't know, there are a lot of things going on, but nothing that I consider strategically significant. It's all domestic politics.
Well, apparently, from what I understand, Petraeus's tenure at the CIA, he actually apparently found it quite uncomfortable where in the culture of the CIA, junior officers are encouraged to speak up. And apparently Petraeus wasn't used to that. He's used to the more top-down, disciplined, giving orders, etc.
Well, that's right. These are two very, very different cultures, and I think the CIA in some ways is almost a unique culture because, in principle, their only mission is to get it right. They're not supposed to, and in theory, do not set the course of policy. They're supposed to stay far away from that. They're not supposed to take sides in policy discussions, but they are expected to provide accurate and long-range thinking on what is taking place. So that's just one more reason. It doesn't take a military officer in that position to be intolerant of independent thinking coming up from the ranks. There have been a lot of civilian leaders as well who have done that. But yes, if you can't speak your mind, even as a junior officer, if you really have a sense of what's going on, if you can't speak your mind, then the organization might as well close its doors.
So do you think that Petraeus' departure and his testimony to the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, do you think that's going to put an end to this Benghazi business? Because the whole thing, you know, obviously it's a tragedy, but it really, you know, it's also stems from a somewhat personal nature, the fact that the American ambassador was on a private personal trip to Benghazi to visit his Arab boyfriend, who was a local guy, and that's why the security wasn't and the footprint wasn't so big. So it seems to me that, given the private nature of this, it'd be better if everybody just shut the hell up.
Yes, as I say, I just don't think there are any serious strategic issues to be discussed. You can argue about whether you should have more protection or less protection, but the fact is, this is a dangerous mission, and these are dangerous countries. And when the United States is militarily involved across the region, there are plenty of aggrieved people, and not only just citizens, but obviously radical groups, some violent, some nonviolent terrorist groups of all kinds. So sadly, American ambassadors and other American officials are prime targets. How do you run an embassy in which, in theory, your people are supposed to get out and on the ground and mix in society to gain information, knowledge, and know people, and at the same time protect them from attack? It's almost a mission impossible.
Again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief, and he's the author of The Future of Political Islam and A World Without Islam. And his latest book is Three Truths and a Lie, a memoir. And just back to Afghanistan, we've spoken before about Afghanistan, and you have a long history with Afghanistan. And I recall you suggesting that in many ways, the U.S.'s problem in the Middle East, in both in Iraq and in particular in Afghanistan, is the very footprint itself, that much of our problems will go away when we reduce our footprint in these Muslim lands. Is that going to happen, do you think, in Afghanistan?
You know, Ian, I don't know. Yes, I think it's going to happen, not because we expect it or intend it to happen, but because simply it's going to prove untenable to maintain that kind of footprint. You know, by the way, I find even the word footprint a bit ironic, because it does suggest a very heavy impact on the region, and yet I noticed the Pentagon for a long, long time now has never had the least sense of irony about talking about the idea of a footprint. But you know, when you have footprint, people get stepped on, and it's not the best word in the world to describe an American presence. I think the State Department prefers the word presence. But in any case, yeah, I don't think it's ever been particularly realistic. I think the entire Afghan war has been, for that matter also the Iraq war, highly unrealistic in on its foundations. And the idea that somehow we are going to be able to maintain bases there, when certainly the next government, and when it and after U.S. troops have gone, the Taliban's presence will be, or footprint, if you want to call it, the Taliban footprint will be vastly greater. I don't want to predict that they're going to run the country entirely. Then that's not a foregone conclusion, but it's going to be a lot less friendly. We're going to have a lot less pliable leadership there. The Pakistanis will have a lot of say in it, which is not anti-American, but it's not pro-American either. So I really wonder how long and to what end, more to the point, to what end we can maintain a presence there that is seemingly non-military, but yet is, and increasingly operated by people who are not professional intelligence officers, training a military that is perhaps an Afghan military that is already heavily infiltrated by people who are anti-American. But particularly, as I say, to what end? We don't have to have American military presence in Afghanistan to try to keep al-Qaeda bases from appearing. I think in the end, the good case can be made that an Afghan government down the road, even a Taliban-influenced government, is not going to find it in its interest to be nourishing little al-Qaeda groups, if they are there, in the interests of getting Western or global support, money, finances, investment, and that type of thing.
Well, even the last Taliban government, the only people that recognized it and supported it were Pakistan and the Saudi Arabians. And the Saudis are not going to give them a dime, you know, since they're implacable enemies of al-Qaeda.
Well, that's right. And even nobody looks into it very much, but even the Taliban were extremely uncomfortable with the presence of al-Qaeda in the last, in the months before leading up to 9/11 and afterwards. They, I think, would in the end, there's a good case can be made that they in the end would have told bin Laden to leave. But I think the Bush administration at that time was in no mood to negotiate in any way whatsoever. I'm not saying there's certainty it would have worked, that he would have been expelled, but there's certainly a possibility of that. And Bush did not wish even to explore that. I think he wanted to move into a war mode.
So, Graham Fuller, the previous guest, Robert Young Pelton, was talking about how we're moving from open wars to covert wars. We're shifting from public wars to private wars. How much is that practical in Afghanistan, the idea that we create these Fort Apaches manned by special forces and contractors, you know, ad infinitum? And the point he was making is that we lost our foothold in Iraq, and Afghanistan's all we've got in that neighborhood.
Well, all we've got is something I think needs to be examined. I think in this day and age, there's a serious question about how the wisdom of trying to plant a major American military base in the heart of Central Asia that is essentially designed to check China and Russia. I don't think that kind of a presence is critical or even helpful in so-called checking China or Russia. The American dealings of relations with China and Russia are going to be taking place all over the globe, and I would really see that kind of a presence as essentially an irritant and a throwback to the old Cold War era of ringing China or ringing Russia or whatever with American bases. Given the contemporary military power, you don't have to have a base right on the Chinese or Russian, close to the Russian border, to make a point. So I'm not very open to the suggestion of, oh my God, we've lost Iraq and now we're going to lose Afghanistan as a presence. I think it's disastrous that we have lost, quote unquote, both of these efforts, because it's destroying American credibility, not some military credibility, yes, but also diplomatic credibility and strategic credibility in our inability to manage the task ahead of us, including dealing with terrorism through the extremely heavy-handed, clumsy means of a military approach. It's not essentially a military problem. So yeah, I'm not. It may be a little lower profile to have contractors there. With all due respect, I think the contractors will be even less well informed and less well disciplined, with less of a tradition of service than, say, in the military or in special forces or CIA or DIA or any of these things. I think it represents a winding down and a deterioration of the quality and capability. And ultimately, as I say, to what end? Surely these guys are going to be targets of anti-American forces, whether it's al-Qaeda or other anti-American groups. After a long American military presence there in a war over 11 years, There are lots and lots of aggrieved people who don't have to sign up with Bin Laden's organization to want to take out some Americans. So I think it's going to be a very rough and ultimately losing game, even in a more covert basis.
So, Graham Fuller, if as a lot of people predict, the Taliban will come back, whether they'll take over the entire country or not, you may go back to a kind of going back to the original situation before 9/11, where the Northern Alliance had a toehold in the north, and the Taliban had basically the rest of the country. I don't quite understand the motivations of the Pakistanis, who clearly support the Taliban and have been undermining the U.S. effort from day one and hedging their bets for a future. Now, they know the U.S. is leaving, so you can understand them wanting to hedge their bets. But on the other hand, why would the Pakistanis want to have a radical government in Afghanistan that's only going to create blowback? They have their own problems with the so-called Pakistan Taliban.
That's exactly right, Ian. But I think we've got to look at the demographics and the geopolitics of the area, which go back a long way. I mean, these people are in the neighborhood forever, and they know, as you say, the American presence is fleeting at best in a historical sense. So the basic fact is that there is Pashtun nationalism, the Pashtun population, which is not quite half of the Afghan population. And if there are the number of Pashtun, there are double the amount of Pashtuns who live on the Pakistan side of the border. The Pashtuns are a very, very important element within the Pakistani society and military and political order. So Pakistan cannot afford. In Pakistan, traditional geopolitical thinking, with this Goliath of India to its east, it cannot afford to be lose strategic depth by having a hostile Afghanistan on the west. So therefore, they know that the connections between the Pashtuns, the huge Pashtun population in Pakistan, and that in Afghanistan is an integral. The border is not even meaningful in that sense. These people cross back and forth. They're the same tribes. They speak the same language. It's long-term, same culture. So this is not really a meaningful border. Any Pakistani government that wants to have good relations with Afghanistan has to be in close and tight with the Pashtun population of Afghanistan. And that's their policy. If these guys are Taliban, so be it. They'll try to control them, moderate them. I think they have or will. But the fact that we've had a raging war right on the Pakistani border is simply radicalized Pakistan's politics itself, and into really an alarming measure. I've never seen such a radical Pakistan, and ever since the state has the Pakistan state was established in late 1940. So that is their calculus. We are going to work with the we're going to work with the Pashtuns, and if the Taliban tend to be the dominant force among them, then that's the way it's going to be.
Well, Graham Fuller, you know, the anti-Americanism in Pakistan is just over the top. It's unbelievable. For example, the young girl that was shot by the Taliban, Malala, who's getting medical treatment in England, the prevailing opinion within Pakistan is that the CIA shot her. I mean, it's unbelievable.
I know it is absolutely unbelievable, but the more you have violence and American drone attacks, which I think have much of the Pashtun areas of Pakistan really up in arms and angry and fearful that these things are going to land on them at any point. They are not the fanaticism is ratcheted up, and it's Pashtun nationalism, but then it mixes with Islam to become even a more potent mixture of hostility to outside forces, to outside the footprints of foreigners. in the area who they see as doing nothing but bringing damage to their nation and in this losing conflict in Afghanistan.
So, Graham Fuller, if as a result of Afghanistan, the U.S. reduces, I hesitate to use the word again, footprint, but if they get out, and will that would a diminishing presence in Afghanistan in Pakistan also make sense? Or would in other words, it doesn't look like the Pakistanis need an excuse for their anti-Americanism. But is there much that the U.S. can do to reduce it? Or perhaps, I don't know how you kind of basically cut bait with a country that has these nuclear weapons. But on the other hand, my understanding is the Pakistanis kind of use their nuclear arsenal as a form of blackmail by saying, you know, you can't afford not to give us funds to keep us solvent. Otherwise, the place will fall apart and the nukes will get loose.
Well, I don't think the Pakistani military has always been a pretty tight-run organization, and I don't think that they have quite engaged in a nuclear blackmail scenario quite like that. But look, you know, I hate to say it, but I think the most single important thing the U.S. can do is remove the footprint. This is perhaps the right word. It is an intensely aggravating factor in Afghan life, and because Pashtuns, in the end, they're Taliban. The Taliban and the Pashtuns are hard to separate out. But I mean, to the extent that Taliban that Pashtuns are involved, Pakistan just is not going to let go on the Afghan side, and they basically want to see U.S. forces out so that the region can begin to calm down. It's going to take quite a while, but it will calm down eventually, because I think once you remove the foreign military presence that's so aggravating. I mean, I think as Americans, we should appreciate what it would be like, saying, having Chinese or Indian or Nigerian troops, all over our country, keeping the peace, quote unquote, or whatever else it was. I mean, we know from American Revolutionary history what it was like having British officers speaking exact same language among us. So I think what American thinking has been quite incapable, insensitive of thinking what the impact of this foreign footprint is. When that footprint is gone, it can begin to deal, I think, with the reality and not deal with the sort of shadow boxing. When you have Americans in Afghanistan, American troops, and huge American presence, then that's the center pole around which the whole game is played. If I'm trying to gain influence in Afghanistan as a Pashtun or as a Northerner, as a Tajik or whatever, I'm going to have to play off the American forces as well. It's an almost unnatural presence. Once that presence is gone, I think it is going to be messy, for sure. It's very messy now. But people are going to have to start dealing with each other and getting down to the fundamentals of creating some kind of new arrangement. And in that capacity, I hope regional states that have great influence, Iran has huge influence on western Afghanistan, Russia has big influence, China can have influence, particularly economic, and India and Pakistan, of course. But unfortunately, I think Washington had, at least in the past, been reluctant to allow certainly Iran to have anything to do whatsoever with a solution, reluctant to let Russia and reluctant even to let China. So we've got to allow regional forces who have a huge stake in this game, bigger than we do, although we're reluctant to admit it. But it matters more to China and Russia and Pakistan and India than it does to us. Let them pick up some of the strategic problems and try to work on it.
So maybe pull the footprint out and let China deal with Pakistan, if indeed you don't need all of these bases, as you say. Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Graham Fuller. I appreciate the time you're able to spend.
My pleasure, Ian.
And
we'll
revisit you soon. I want to talk to you about this extraordinary new book that you've got, Three Truths and a Lie, a memoir.
Okay, great. With pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. Graham Fuller has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam and A World Without Islam. His latest book is Three Truths and a Lie, a Memoir. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and ask questions if you have them at the moment. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.